Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
Up first is Dr. Nick Pappas talking about sexual deviancy in sports and how you can protect your son or daughter from being abused or violated. Perverse behavior is rampant in the world of sports, and being educated can help lower the risk of becoming a victim. We then chat with recording artist Maya Davies about her career with her group Ladies of the Canyon, as well as her new solo CD, Héritage, where she sings in both French and English. Gina Lee of The Love Zone is here, and we wrap things up with a remix from Ellie Goulding, Anything Could Happen.
Capture your need for sound.
In 2011, we all heard about the Penn State scandal involving football's assistant coach Jerry Sandusky's sexual assault on underage players. Retired NHL hockey player Theo Fleury also stood up and told the world about the abuse he suffered at the hands of his minor league hockey coach, Graham James. But has the code of silence on sexual abuse in sports really been broken? Dr. Nick Pappas is a former collegiate and professional ice hockey player and coach who studied human development and family science and sociology of sport. Dr. Nick Pappas coached hockey for over 25 years, including coaching at Penn State hockey camps. He most recently wrote a book called The Dark Side of Sports, exposing the sexual culture of collegiate and professional sports. Throughout his many years of coaching, he has seen an array of sexual deviant and aggressive behavior occurring outside of sport at a variety of levels, beginning in high school. Dr. Nick joins us today to discuss some of his findings and ways to go about addressing and preventing athlete sexual deviancy. Dr. Nick, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on your show today.
Can you explain what athlete sexual deviancy is and how it differs from athlete sexual aggression?
Well, during my career as a collegiate and professional athlete and coach, I saw things that were not always illegal or aggressive, but they were kind of the sleazier, seedier things that go on in the athlete culture. Not always illegal, always harmful in the way that they were targeting others, particularly women. And these behaviors were flying under the radar. So they were not being addressed by coaches, not appearing in the media, and they were often rampant. And so these were kind of the more seedier, sleazier, I almost want to say perverted type of stuff. And they were stepping stones oftentimes that could easily cross the line to illegal behavior such as sexual aggression.
What are some of the underlying causes of athlete sexual deviancy, you know, and or aggression?
When we're looking at the causes, it's you can't just say, okay, here's the cause, we're going to wipe this out and we'll be good to go with getting rid of all of the deviancy and or aggression in the athlete culture. There's a lot of different influences that come together and they kind of converge. And I'll go through these now. And the first is this thing called athlete privilege, where it's the notion that the athlete has the idea that they are a star, they're successful, and they're above the law. So it's a sense of entitlement to do what they want to do. With this often comes an absence of deterrence or a lack of consequences. So when athletes aren't being disciplined for these behaviors, it gives them a green light to continue. And too often coaches are giving them a slap on the wrist, if that at all, or it's different consequences for the third stringer versus the star on the team. A lot of the sexual deviancy has to do with this thing called masculinity or masculinity displays, where storytelling, according to one athlete, fueled 85% of the deviancy that was going on his team. So the storytelling is huge, humor, entertainment. Who can be the most over-the-top, out-of-control guy? So there's a lot of bragging and bravado that goes along with these practices. Now add the component of alcohol. And alcohol, as we know, makes you do things that you would never do sober. And we're not talking about just a six-pack here. We're talking about anywhere from 15 to 20 beers for certain athletes. Peer pressure is very strong in the athlete culture. And guys will take their competition and try to one-up each other with behaviors that leave the practice field, leave the game situations, and move into the realm of competitions with females and things like that. Now add the component of female sexual availability, which a lot of females are following teams beginning in high school right through college and into the pros. Not that these behaviors wouldn't happen if there wasn't female availability, but females making themselves sexually available in ways that are unimaginable only encourages these type of behaviors. And then finally, for some athletes, these so-called entertaining behaviors, sexual encounters, behaviors of all kinds, do indeed cross the line to sexual addiction, compulsion, and obsessions. And numerous athletes talked about their own as well as what they saw in teammates.
While in the process of writing your book, what were the biggest challenges you faced?
You know, I think it had to do with probably the major leaguers, whether they be the NHLers, the NFL players, Major League Baseball, or the NBA players, because a lot of them had been burned by journalists, misquoted, and they were very hesitant to share stories with me, let alone talk with me at all, because of the type of study I was doing. I mean, I'm talking about sexual deviancy, sexual aggression here, and you know, things you wouldn't often tell your best friend. And so it was to my advantage to have been an athlete and coach at the college and pro level, so I can say, you know, hey, you know, and I will also, you know, this is the way I could bond with them. And I would also share a study I did with them of athletes I had coached in college and showed them and said, hey, look at the way the words are used. No names, no teams, no identifying information. We're just trying to get information here about the phenomenon, to look at it, to examine it, and to draw some conclusions from this. And so breaking down those barriers and walls, so to speak, were the biggest challenge. But once I got them to trust me that, you know, I'm one of you in that I was an athlete and a coach, and, you know, and I'm not looking to tarnish anyone's personal reputation by using names. Now, names were used in the book, The Dark Side of Sports, my book, if it was public record, if it already appeared in a newspaper or a book or a magazine, I would use names. But anybody I interviewed for the book, The Dark Side of Sports, their names were guaranteed anonymity and confidentiality and would not be used in the book.
What do your findings, I guess, have in common, you know, with that awful situation with the Penn State University scandal? And I guess a sidebar to that, you know, were you actually surprised to hear about the scandal, or was it something waiting to happen that you knew eventually something like this would happen?
Well, Penn State University and the sex scandal associated with that school is extremely disturbing to me because it was one of two universities that I played my college hockey at. And then I worked hockey schools in the summers for anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks for the next 25 years. So I came in contact with Jerry Sandusky without ever meeting him. I knew who he was. He knew who I was, and that second mile group that he was grooming his victims from would sometimes stay in the same dormitory as the hockey players that I coached, just on different floors. It was extremely disturbing in that it highlighted the fact that, you know, there were all kinds of harmful sexual abuse that was going on that was being swept under the carpet by high-ranking officials. They were looking the other way. They were ignoring it. They were denying it. They were not following up. And this let the abuse continue for over 10 years. This situation has similarities to what I wrote about in my book, The Dark Side of Sports, because there was a reoccurring theme also where athletes I talked to said, you know, coaches didn't want to know about this. They were looking the other way. And so they could easily say, hey, I didn't know what was going on, and they were honest. So there's a reoccurring theme in my book of cover-ups, administrators, coaches not addressing these things, not disciplining the players for these behaviors, which in essence gives them a green light to continue. And, you know, if the discipline is a joke, the players know it. They don't take the coaches, the administrators seriously. And, you know, these behaviors, sexually deviant behaviors, which are the theme of my book, you know, they're allowed to run rampant. And I guess the big message for parents pertaining to my book, The Dark Side of Sports, is even though my book focuses on college and pro athletes' sexual deviancy and aggression, parents need to know that every single type of sexually deviant or aggressive behavior I found at the college and pro level was also found among high school athletes in a variety of sports. And that's a huge message for parents who have athletes and parents who have daughters who are the targets of these practices more so than not.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about Joe Paterno, because I'm a huge football fan, a college football fan. I've been, you know, following it for a long time, even up here in Canada. And I just want to give you my sense of Joe Paterno. Like, he was always presented, you know, on the television. Obviously, I've never met the man, but he was always presented as an upstanding guy, you know, someone to look up to. His players looked up to him. You know, the community at large looked up to him. He was basically a god down in Happy Valley. So when you spoke about how high-ranking officials, you know, let things slide, I know that this has polarized the community down there because some people are like, can't believe that maybe Joe Paterno knew what was going on and didn't deal with things. What's your take on the Joe Paterno angle of this whole Jerry Sandusky story?
Well, my take on this is based on the Free report where Free was hired to do a investigation at Penn State to get to the bottom of what happened. And, you know, his findings highlighted the fact that Paterno, the athletic director Tim Curley, Gary Schultz, and the president of the university, Graham Spanier, knew about these events when they first started back in 1998. These officials lied about what they knew and never addressed the situation. As it continued, as one incident after another continued to appear. So three of the officials that are still alive, Paterno obviously passed away, are going to be on trial this January or February. Their trial is coming up for perjury, as well as failure to protect children, because they knew about information according to the emails that were uncovered in the Free report. And so while Paterno never used computers or email, he was mentioned after conversations with these individuals that he supposedly said, no, I don't reveal this information to the authorities. And that stopped the process of where Tim Curley was, you know, planning to turn this information into authorities. And so very, very disturbing. And that was the reason that Free report was the reason his statue came down. All of it, his name came off of all of these trophies. And you see the ramifications with the Penn State NCAA sanctions, in addition to all the losses, all the wins that turned into losses as a result of the situation.
Were you surprised in the fact that these upper management officials let this slide? Because here's my position that really confuses me in the fact that, you know, we talked a little bit earlier, or you mentioned earlier how, you know, if you're the star athlete on the team, you often can get away with, you know, more deviant behavior because you're producing and you're the star and everyone looks up to you and all that sort of stuff. My question when it comes to Sandusky is, you know, he wasn't the head coach of the team. He was a coach, but it just seems sort of implausible to me that upper management wouldn't realize we need to get rid of this guy. Like, you know, he's not got the golden grail. He's just a regular defensive coordinator. We can deal with this. We can get someone else. And it's just shocking to me that they let this go on. Not that you should let the star athlete or the star coach get away with anything, but it's almost to me like, who was this guy that all these upper management let it slide?
You know, that's a great question. And I think a lot of this turns into a bit of denial. I saw a headline that said one perpetrator, many accomplices, and that kind of highlighted this situation, because when people deny it, they ignore it, or they just don't want to deal with it for whatever reason, because it is definitely a dirty part of whether we're talking about the sports culture or any other of these organizations where these allegations and convictions and cover-ups occurred. Catholic Church, Boy Scouts of America, you know, different youth organizations. It's definitely something a lot of people don't want to deal with. And so, you know, thinking it's going to go away or things will work itself out obviously is not the case. You know, in Canada, you had the situation with Graham James, and, you know, the trash talk for years was, you know, he was abusing his players, and everybody kind of laughed it off until all of a sudden, you know, Sheldon Kennedy and other players started coming forth and saying, yes, this did happen to me. So as shocking as it was at Penn State, you know, it happened in junior hockey with a very high-profile coach, Graham James. And, you know, people not following up on the clues, on the information that should have been followed up on is basically what allows us to go. And, you know, Penn State, you know, you can only, you know, kind of conjecture that, you know, they're thinking they're going to try to save their pristine image of a program that had never had any violations. And by doing this, you know, it brought a firestorm of negative publicity and all kinds of sanctions because it was not addressed when it should have been addressed. Plus, the human cost was just outrageous in the number of victims that continue to be abused because high-ranking officials didn't step up and say, you can't do this. We're going to stop this right here and now.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is Dr. Nick Pappas, author of The Dark Side of Sports, Exposing the Sexual Culture of Collegiate and Professional Sports. For more information, make sure to check out his website, drnickpappas.com. Dr. Nick, I wanted to ask you as well about, you know, athlete sexual deviancy. What, I guess, behavior out of that is most surprising to you?
Well, you know, it begins in the athlete culture, in the locker room setting, first and foremost, with the hazing, the initiations. So, you know, I found about 80% of the guys I talked to knew about the hazings, initiations, but 45%, which is over half of those, talked about the sexualized hazing that goes on. Shaving of the genitals, all kinds of games involving marshmallow walks, putting guys, eight guys in a bathroom naked on the back of the bus and having them come out with their clothes, all kinds of different things. But it doesn't only stop at the initiations because, you know, there's a lot of other ways that athletes will target each other with deviant practices, exhibitionist practices. And the idea that if guys are willing to target each other, who they're supposed to be closely bonded to as teammates, well, how are they going to treat females who are just casual sexual partners is the question. And so while the things that go on, and interestingly, this past summer, right up through the fall, I came across at the high school level of the sports among three different incidences that involved soccer players, wrestlers, basketball, and football players where athletes were actually charged with sexual assault due to some of these hazing incidences. Coaches were involved in two of the situations, and there was a cover-up that involved superintendent, principal, and coaches at the school where one of these. And these occurred at the high school level, and they occur more often at the professional and collegiate level as well. But these were just three instances that I came across this past summer. So, again, if athletes are willing to target their own, well, where does that leave females? And it is not good in that, you know, I came across disturbing situations that involve competitions and contests. And these were both formal and informal, but 75% of the guys knew about this and a third participated. So we're talking about here elaborate point systems, spreadsheets, rules of all kinds to compete with one another to have sex with females. They're using different types of sexual behaviors in these competitions, different types of females who could belong to certain organizations. I mean, it was just stunning because women, in essence, become the next sport when the practice is over or the game is finished. Another one is the voyeurism, where guys aren't just content to watch pornography, which is rampant in the athlete culture, because they want to make their own. 75% of the guys knew about this, and a third, again, had experience. And what they do is they set up a situation where they're going to bring back a female to a room, and guys are already staked out in the room to watch the situation. Sometimes this will involve non-consensual recording of the sexual encounter, but some of the athletes told me that one out of every two situations, guys are trying to join these situations, which either means it's going to be a group sexual experience if the female consents, or a group sexual assault, which is more often the case because the female's intoxicated, it's a darkened room, she doesn't know she's being switched up upon. So very, very disturbing situations that turn from sexual deviancy and can cross the line to sexual assault. Now, the group sex is an extremely common phenomenon in the athlete culture because 95% of the guys I talked to knew about it, a third participated, and from that third, most of the guys, 70% were involved in these larger situations involving anywhere from 4 to 15 athletes. And so the problem here is a very common phenomenon, but the problem is that what guys call gangbangs, trains, threesomes, foursomes, tensomes, whatever, are in fact sexual assaults because the female is often intoxicated, guys are switching up or joining the situations without consent, there's non-consensual acts taking place, And plenty of athletes talked about how there was definitely physical and sexual aggression occurring in these situations. And oftentimes the female would pass out and guys would just continue the assault and the rape on the female. So 30% of the guys knew about this. So we're talking about extremely disturbing situations that are rampant in the athlete culture at the college and pro level, and were found at in virtually every sport at the high school level, which again is a huge message for parents.
You've mentioned that a lot of these coaches and even higher ranking officials, whether it's the school principal or, you know, the athletic director, that oftentimes these people know that this behavior like a hazing is going on. My question is, in all of your research and you know, experiences and travels around to these different schools, have you ever come upon an actual coach who has cracked down on hazing and any of this so that, you know, it's really a tight ship? Because I'm wondering if you actually have found one of these, you know, people who was a stand-up person, just how different that locker room is.
You know, there are coaches, and I have met them, and, you know, there are some that, you know, have a no-tolerance policy with regard to something like hazing, where if it happens, you're gone if the coach finds out about it. Problem is, coach often doesn't find out about these things until after the fact. But there are some coaches also that I've come across that had a kind of a policy and rule where if there's a fight going on and anybody that's an athlete that's there does nothing to try to stop it, well, those guys are going to sustain consequences just like the athlete that got in the fight. So, you know, there are some coaches that understand the peer influences that relate to this. Now, these same policies need to be implemented when we're talking about the sexual deviancy, because, you know, things like the competitions and contests, the voyeurism, these are happening in group settings, the group sex. This isn't happening with one athlete alone. This is happening in a group setting, and guys have to be taught, reinforced that this can't happen on our team. This can't victimize others. This cannot soil our team, soil the athlete culture, and any minute take down our program. Guys have to be taught to step up and become leaders when they see and encounter these situations and say, you can't do this. This can't happen on our team. And I have instances in my book, as well as narratives and quotes that didn't make it into the book, where guys talked about they knew a group sexual situation was going to go on with an intoxicated female, which is group sexual assault. And a player stepped in a number of times and stopped the situation. Or guys would see a female that was passed out, that guys were thinking about having sex with her, or which is in fact sexual assault and rape, and stopped the situation. And I even have an instance in my book where a guy stopped his teammates while a group sexual assault and rape was in progress. Now, this is an interesting scenario because in an article in 1991, I came across the director of the Santa Monica Rape Center who said she'd never come across any situations in her 20 years of someone stopping a group sexual assault in progress. So I called her up 20 years later and said, you know, is this still the case? And she said, yes. And I told her that there was an instance in my book where an athlete actually stopped his teammates during a group sexual assault and rape of a female. And, you know, unfortunately, that case is not the common type of scenario. The more common is guys watching these situations and doing nothing to stop it. But, you know, in that case, we need more of that in the athlete culture. That man did nothing short of a heroic act by stepping in and saying, you can't do this. It's bad for our team. It's victimizing this person. It's not going to happen. And we definitely need more of these kind of situations to happen.
What's your advice to parents and coaches and other officials to make this stop, to help really be proactive and stop this behavior?
Well, with regard to athlete sexual deviancy and aggression, you need to look for some of the telltale signs that can provide clues that this stuff is happening. And I think one of the first and foremost situations is to listen to the ways the athletes are talking about young women. Because if it's if the language is full of disrespectful, sexist language, jokes, this is a significant part of the process that is part of this sexual deviancy and aggression, this disrespectful language. Then look at the way the athletes are treating females in general. Is it disrespectful? Again, with is sexist attitudes just flying all over the place with this stuff? Because these are important steps and components of sexual deviancy and assault. It's important also to look at the pornography influence, which can be rampant in the college and pro ranks. And we know that 12 to 17-year-olds are the largest consumer of internet pornography. And pornography acts as a how-to guide for many males. It not only promotes the harmful, demeaning attitudes, but it encourages athletes, according to my study, who said, you know, hey, I wanted to try out these things I was seeing. So it acts as a how-to guide. It's also important to look for the peer groups that athletes are part of, because deviant peer groups are going to try to outdo each other to bring in the most outrageous story. So they're going to compete with each other for sex with women, attempt to one-up each other to see who can come up with the most deviant thing that they could do with a female. It's also important to look at substance abuse, because these behaviors are most often occurring while guys are under the influence of drugs and alcohol. So if the substance abuse with these other components are prevalent, you know that this stuff may be going on. And then finally, it's also important to look at, the communication that the guys are having with each other, whether that's on Facebook, texting, the tweets, the chats, or the posts, to see if these messages are containing deviant, you know, attitudes, behaviors, and stories that guys are trying to play off of one another on. And basically, then, it's about asking the athletes about their awareness and experiences with this stuff, you know, talking to coaches, talking to the team leaders, and finding out what you can, particularly if, you have an athlete, talk to that athlete. You know, say, hey, this stuff is going on. This is the purpose of my presentations to athletes and coaches. This is the purpose of my book, The Dark Side of Sports, to raise awareness to these type of things, because you can't address what you don't know is happening. And so, you know, talk to them. Let them know that, you know, this stuff is happening. Make sure you're not part of it. If it's happening on your team, the parent needs to let their kid know, I need to know about this. We need to alert coaches, administrators, and a number of people so that it can't be swept under the carpet. Parents also have to talk to their daughters, because daughters have no idea the different ways that they would be targeted by groups of charismatic, fun-loving athletes who are put on these pedestals. And a lot of these situations where they're targeted are going to appear and happen at parties where there's alcohol and groups of athletes. So females need to know that, you know, if they're planning to have a sexual encounter at some of these social events, know that they can be targeted in all kinds of different ways, which I briefly talked about tonight, and they need to, you know, take steps to protect themselves. And alcohol and being under the influence of alcohol and drugs is a big risk factor for these practices.
Dr. Pappas, where can people get a copy of your book?
Well, my website, www.drnickpappas.com, has extensive information about the book. It has links to Amazon.com. and links to Barnes & Noble, but it can be purchased from virtually any bookseller. My website also contains information about my presentations that I do to athletes and coaches and other groups like teachers. And, you know, there's just general resources for parents in the way of interviews, past interviews, as well as YouTube videos that talk about these issues. So, you know, it's about raising awareness, and the book took 12 years to do, because a lot of the information in the book has never appeared in print before. And, you know, it has a message for numerous people, both in the sports world and out of the sports world, parents, females, as was mentioned. And, you know, we don't start addressing this stuff, it just isn't going to stop by itself.
Dr. Pappas, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me on your show.
That was Dr. Nick Pappas, again, author of The Dark Side of Sports, Exposing the Sexual Culture of Collegiate and Professional Sports. For more information, go to www.drnickpappas.com.
Stand by.
The Love Zone with Gina Lee
on The Kelly Alexander Show.
I'm Gina Lee, and today's topic in The Love Zone is about getting your ex back. No, I don't mean getting revenge. I mean getting them back into a relationship with you. A few weeks ago, we talked about how to get over your ex. But what if you don't want to get over them? What if you think your love deserves another chance? Hey, you never know what you have until it's gone. And sometimes that's the wake-up call needed to take a relationship seriously. But what do you do when it's already over? Well, I'll tell you this much. Timing is everything, and individual cases will vary, especially when it comes to how you broke up. If your ex caught you cheating with their best friend or you gambled away their life savings, well, you might want to wait a while before trying to mend that bridge, if it can be mended at all. And that's the thing, there's no guarantee to this. There are some people who don't go back to what they left behind, and others who are always willing to give things another try. If the breakup was relatively straightforward and civil, and the person doesn't hate you, things just didn't work out for some minor reason or the other, then maybe there's a possibility for a love revival. So how will you know whether the water is warm or cold? Dip a toe in. Send a quick, hey, how you doing, email or text. Something friendly, upbeat, and short. If you get no response, or a response that pretty much says, get lost, then leave it alone. Maybe it's too soon to reach out or they've moved on and you'll have to do the same. But if you get a positive reply and they seem open to conversation, then you can step it up a notch. Send a longer email or see if you can talk to them on the phone. But this is where you need to be clear with your intentions. Lay it all out, say that you're interested in rekindling the relationship, and list the reasons why. If there's an apology to be made or promises to be pledged, now is the time. But don't beg or sound desperate. And if you are desperate, then I advise you to not even try to get back with your ex. The worst thing you could do is to start a relationship from a position of desperation. It will not work. Make sure you're approaching this from a healthy and mature standpoint. Don't try to get back with your ex just because you're not comfortable with being single. You know them, they know you, so why bother finding somebody new? Don't do that. If you broke up, it was for a reason. And if that issue doesn't get addressed, it will rear its ugly head again. So you really have to be sure that you're going into this with the intent of doing better than the last time around. If you really think that you are good for them and they are good for you, go for it. Good luck.
I'll tell you you're right when you
joining us on The Kelly Alexander Show is recording artist Maya Davies, who's not only found success as a solo artist, but is part of a country folk quartet, Ladies of the Canyon. Maya has also the distinction of being an artist who can record in two languages, French and English. Maya, welcome to The Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks for having me.
Maya, it's commonly known that, you know, being a singer and an entertainer is a very challenging career choice. Why did you decide to pursue, you know, a career in music, or do you think that it actually chose you?
I mean, yeah, I do have that feeling that it chose me rather than I chose it. But I guess I was still quite young when I made the decision that I wanted to do this, and it was really based on just my love for it and love for songwriting and singing. And I don't think I really knew yet how challenging it can be until I actually went out there and did it. But, you know, now that I have done it, it's just kind of how my life is, and I see it as challenging, but I see it also as really enriching and just kind of a big part of what's made me who I am.
How did you actually kickstart your career?
I mean, when you talk about entertainment careers, there's very few people who get started very quickly and then have this one moment that defines the rest of the career. It was sort of like it's always been a very slow build of different events for me. And I started just as a songwriter and a solo singer, and trying to make records and get known. And eventually I made a few records in New York and sort of skirted around a few record deals, met Ladies of the Canyon, and our journey sort of been a long, slow climb uphill with them as well. Just, you know, it's the combination of different shows that you have a chance to do, different people that you get to meet in the recording industry, little victories along the way that kind of define the bigger picture in the long run.
What made you decide to go from a solo artist at one point, you know, to becoming part of a group, you know, with Ladies of the Canyon? Was it a challenging sort of curve to being by yourself to now, you know, having bandmates?
At the time, I didn't really think so. I thought I was feeling maybe a bit lonely in the music industry, and I was quite young and being faced with these really huge challenges and a lot of, you know, there's a lot of rejection involved in trying to, you know, whether you're a singer or an actor or anything in the entertainment industry, because there's so many people who want to do it. And it was a lot for me to handle alone, and it was just very refreshing for me to meet these other girls who I had a lot in common with musically, and I just wanted to make it about the music at that point in my life, because it was just too much business going on, or too much of the industry, and I really just wanted to play in a band and play music that I liked, and that's what that group offered me.
You spoke before about being in New York, and obviously you are from Canada. Is it a different vibe when you're down there writing as opposed to being, you know, at home?
Yeah, New York has a very vibrant, big quality to it that I don't know if it exists very many places in the world. Maybe in Paris, maybe in L.A. You have to be in a really big place. New York has a lot of art as well, just so many people, even when you walk down the street. It puts you in a different state of mind just to be constantly surrounded by this constantly moving energy.
Mm-hmm. So,
and people, you know, there's a lot of people working in music in New York. You know, same thing when you go down to, you know, whether it's Nashville or if you go to L.A., there's a lot expected out of you all the time. And I think for me, it has never really deterred me or scared me. It's more given me more motivation. And I have a tendency to write more songs and to have a higher creative output when I go into more challenging cities in the world.
Joining us on the show is recording artist Maya Davies. Make sure to check her out on Twitter at Maya Music. Can you tell us about your latest album, Héritage, and why you chose to sing most of those songs in French?
Right. Well, I am from Montreal, from a bilingual family, and I grew up going to school in French in high school, and I went to college in English, so I definitely have both of those cultural backgrounds in me, and they're both important. But I've been working in English for so long, that just became, you know, what I did, and therefore most of the people I was surrounded by were Anglophone. And when Ladies of the Canyon, we sort of had a nice kind of break in Quebec a few years ago, and we started touring very heavily there and all across the province. And of course, those were in mostly French-speaking areas. So I was the only French-speaking member of the band, so I became kind of the liaison between everyone, and began speaking on stage in French. And I really, through traveling around across the province and even listening to the French radio when we were traveling during the daytime and talking to people, it just kind of reawakened in me this part of me I hadn't checked in on in a while, I think. And it was just kind of a snowball effect after that. And I started listening to a lot more French music again, and I was inspired to write some songs in French. And they just kind of flowed out of me, and before I knew it, I had a whole album's worth. So I decided, and you know, I couldn't bring French songs really into the Ladies of the Canyon because we're an Anglophone group, and the other girls don't speak or sing in French. So it became clear that it was a little venture that I had to do on my own.
Do you find that when you are writing in French or even performing in French, it's different parts of you, or is it still, you know, Maya Davies?
No, that's the thing about me is that I am those two parts, you know. There's part of me that has an English cultural background, and there's part of me that has a French cultural background, and that's the culture, the arts, the language, different languages can evoke different feelings there, different emotion, different concepts that the others don't, you know, like some words in English aren't perfectly translatable in French, you know, that's just the nature of different languages. So it definitely, I think it rounds me out nicely as a person and gives me, an interesting quality that I definitely appreciate having around. And when I write in English, when I write in French, I pool, obviously, from the separate sides, but I don't have multiple personalities, mm-hmm. or I just speak two languages. So obviously there's a crossover of the two in who I am.
What do you want your fans to take away, you know, from this album?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I made it because I had the desire to write those songs and express myself. It's a very personal album. The lyrics are very honest. I didn't really mean it for it to come out that way, but it just became kind of a portrait of me during a certain period of my life, and I think I was really heavily searching for something within myself and around me, and I think that's something a lot of people can relate to. So it's for people who are kind of in the mood for a little bit of a soul-searching moment in their lives, I think. I've been told it's good for road trips, and you know, the main thing is that I wanted to make this record also because I wanted to play it and sing it and communicate with you know, Quebec audiences mostly, and I really wanted to have a chance to tell my stories in a language and in both languages that the people of this province that we all have in common, and that is our kind of special history, and I wanted to live that and be part of it with them.
Now, you talked before, or I mentioned before, actually, that you have a Twitter account, so you're definitely obviously on social media. Have you noticed that being, you know, involved in social media has helped to propel your career to another level? Because as we've seen, if we just take a look at the biggest social media star right now, which would be Justin Bieber, who has millions of Twitter followers, like, obviously, he sort of comes from that aspect, like he was found through social media on YouTube. Have you noticed being a part of social media has helped, I guess, A, propel your career, and then B, forged a closer relationship with your fans?
I mean, I'm not, you know, Justin Bieber is obviously, we're not of the same age group.
Right.
And he's, you know, I think that's a bit of a different era that's happening right now, especially, and that's, you know, that's pop music and very extreme popular culture, whereas I you know, I do those things and I do the Facebook and the Twitter, but I really kind of take it with a grain of salt, and for me it's not, I don't, it's it's not important for me to for that to be a way to propel my music and to use it. I think what's interesting about that is that, like you said, it does give people a very, gives every one of us a very, even though it's over the internet, kind of a very almost intimate connection between everyone. You know, it's very, we can be very close and know someone's thoughts, even though we've never met them. And I think that that's interesting, and it's a good platform to share your ideas and to communicate with people. But I'm still maybe old school, and I want the music to speak for itself. And yeah, for me, it's just about the music. You know, the rest is just icing, I guess you could call it.
Now, what's up next for you in the next 12 to 18 months?
Oh, God. Well, I'm finishing my tour right now. I'm on tour all across Quebec. And then the Ladies of the Canyon, I go straight from the tour right into the studio, and we're finishing up our second record, which is going to be launched in March. So I've got kind of a heavy schedule also next year of touring and maybe make a couple videos for everyone to see. and then the ladies are going to get back on the road too. And we've made kind of a little bit of a interesting left turn creatively. And there's lots of new sounds and things on our album that we look forward to kind of showing off. And we're putting together kind of a big show. So I think it'll be... Every year I say the next year is going to be probably the most interesting of my life, but it keeps getting truer and truer. Every year it gets more complicated and more challenging and more interesting and more fulfilling.
Now, we have fans right now that are listening around the world to the show, and where can people actually get a copy of your album if, you know, people listening are hearing about Maya Davies for the first time?
Oh, well, it's on iTunes, so that's pretty simple. And the website has all kinds of... news and links to buy the album as well, which is Maya, M-A-I-A, music, like in French, M-U-S-I-Q-U-E.com.
Fantastic. Maya, thank you so much for your time today. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That's recording artist Maya Davies. And again, make sure to check her out on her webpage as well as through Twitter at Maya Music.
I know you don't like to worry. You want to live like a gypsy in this song. Thank you.
That's Ellie Goulding with Anything Could Happen, the almighty radio edit on The Kelly Alexander Show. Thank you very much to my guest this week, Dr. Nick Pappas, as well as Maya Davies. I want to leave you with your inspirational quote of the week, this time from Ayn Rand. Money is only a tool. It will take you wherever you wish, but it will not replace you as the driver. Please don't forget to check us out on our website, kellyalexandershow.com. Lots of blogs going on, also new episodes, just a ton of things to check out. So make sure you do that. Also, I want to officially announce that we have launched a new show for kellyalexandershow.com. It's actually a show called 90s Now, featuring myself and our music editor, Sharon Hyland. And we're very excited for you to take a listen. Again, it's called 90s Now. You can find it on our kellyalexandershow.com page. There's a tab called 90s Now. Just click it and press play and let me know what you think. Kelly at kellyalexandershow.com. Also, please follow us on Twitter for The Kelly Alexander Show, K Alexander Show, as well as for our new show, 90s Now, at 90s Now FM. Have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.